and welcome to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian.
And that's right, folks. We looked under rocks, big and small, and I actually managed to find Sebastian.
I've been here the whole time. I don't know which.
But you're right. Our regular listeners would recall that just last week I was in Vancouver with the incredibly talented guests that I had joining me there, such as Jane J. McCullough. Did you see the Ig Nobel Prize that came out for Our Cat's Liquid?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. That was, I think that was the 2017 physics.
Yeah.
Not biology, because biology, I think, had something to do with the mating practices of frogs. I love the Ig Nobels. I can't believe, I think they stream the awards every year. I think as well as, you know, Eurovision. And over the weekend, I got dragged out to a Royal Rumble event because, you know, newsflash, I'm a gay man and apparently I'm into pro wrestling now. And actually, I had my very first moment where I heard somebody's unique theme song playing before they came in and I knew exactly who it was and I was super excited. And it was Kairi Sane, the Pirate Princess. I love her. She makes me laugh every time I see her. But anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, right. We should have like an Ig Nobel's party and just,
yeah,
like, because it's hilarious.
And just live stream them.
Yeah. Right. Like how they made a musical out of the necrophilic duck paper.
I didn't.
There's an hour and a half long musical based on necrophilic ducks.
All links will be on our website, www.canqueer.news. Anyway, so back to the point. We had JJ McCullough, who did this really great video. Like I said, I haven't done it justice. He's a columnist with the Washington Post, talking about Canadian politics. And he joined myself, Kaylee Sage, the voluptuous voice behind In Rainbows,
mm-hmm,
and the incredibly talented Madeline Taylor as well.
We don't have sexy voices.
No, I know.
Apparently, people think you're in your 50s.
I know. I am going to name and shame right now, because when I was in Vancouver, I met with one of our listeners, one of the many listeners that we have, and I absolutely loved that he said to me, it's like he gets to tune in and listen to his two gay friends talking about what's happening in the world.
Right, yeah.
And I just thought that was great, that sort of idea that, you know, you're just hanging out, you're driving home, and you're just like overhearing a conversation.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I appreciate that.
That is on purpose. We are...
I thought I was 50.
I wonder how old people think I am. And do they know that I'm the older between
I know, us? I know. I'm actually 17. I'm not 17. I'm 28. But it's like, it came up because I was there for my birthday. And I said, oh, I'm celebrating my 28th birthday. And he was shocked. I also have a beard, so that may have thrown him a bit. But no, he thought I was 50 based on my voice.
Yeah, in the right lighting, you look older than me as well.
Thank you, I think. Someone's not getting invited to my next party.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, no. There is a very deliberate sort of barstool atmosphere that we are trying to create here, mm-hmm, though, where it's more about, you know, chit-chatting, and it's mostly about news, but I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, the last week, there was a lot of news.
There have been.
There's a lot of things that we have opinions on, obviously, mm-hmm, and a lot of things that I think it's extremely important that we have a conversation about.
There have been times where you text me before we show up and you're like, this thing happened. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about it because the only way to talk about it is to spend the entire episode talking about that one thing. And if we do less than that, we're not going to do it justice and it's going to be terrible and I'll be embarrassed. And you're like, yep, nope, that seems fair. I didn't want to talk about it either. I was just double checking.
Yeah, this is not the entirety of all the things that happen.
No, it's small, more cultural landmarks we do that with actual news stories, events in the world, things that make the news. We rarely say that about, but like, yeah, like the Gillette commercial, the two of us were like, and then we talked about it after the episode.
Yeah.
That's fine. But let's start with this.
Yeah. So the first one is pretty serious news. It is, and actually I think we'll talk about what happened. And actually I want to have a conversation with you about what I think the impact might be, how it segues to our next story.
Okay.
So last Tuesday, Bruce MacArthur, the serial killer in Toronto who targeted South Asian men, from the gay scene in Toronto admitted and pled guilty to 8 counts of first-degree murder.
Okay.
In the murders of Salim Essen, Andrew Kissman, Mahid Kayan, Dean Lysowick, Sarush Mahmoudi, Skarajab Navaratnam, and Abdul Basar Faizi, and Karushna Kanagaratnam.
Okay.
So he pled guilty to all of those murders.
Did he plead guilty to more than that? Because if I remember correctly, because I do have a moderately good memory for the news story, they were, the police were following him around because he was a suspect, and they decided to raid him earlier than expected because he took another person home. So apparently when they arrested him, there was another person there that was probably going to be another attempt at another victim.
Well, yeah.
So that should be an attempted murder plea as well.
Well, who knows? We don't know.
Oh, it's just the news is only reporting on this, but there's probably like a dozen other things.
Yeah, so okay. What's really interesting was that he pled guilty, which means there won't be a long court case.
Yeah.
His family isn't going to have to endure months and months and months.
Right.
We are going to be seeing the impact statements from the victims' families and friends coming out within the next week or so. They may have just come out, actually, as you're hearing this.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll touch on some of those next week, because, of course, the impact of these lost folks is quite monumental. But the Toronto Police Service wasn't willing to talk about if any deal had been struck in order to get him to plead guilty, as opposed to going through the whole court case. We do know that some information was revealed, but not all of the information. There was an agreement on the facts of the case that came out.
Okay.
The sort of synopsis of which became public when he pleaded guilty.
Well, the other thing is, those were 8 victims. And from what I understand, there's another suspected half dozen to dozen other bodies that they found that are believed to be attributed to Bruce MacArthur. But last I heard, they had not yet been identified. And they were having troubles linking them to missing persons. Now, this was all back in like November, and there haven't been, as far as I've been able to tell, any updates on this. So
the agreed statement of facts,
okay,
which is what they had, it was issued in the court that between 2010 and 2017 he killed the 8 men.
Okay,
so it is from the last 7 years,
right?
What was really shocking when the news first broke the end of 2017, early 2018, when he was arrested, was when Mike Edzinger, the lead investigator, said that what was really shocking was that the skill with which he had executed the murder was not one that you would expect of someone without any practice.
Right. Yeah.
And that was really unsettling. It's like, okay, well, clearly this is somebody who's been doing it for some time.
Yeah.
He has pled guilty here to murders over a 7-year period.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know about him in general is that he was married when I was a child. The marriage broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was afterwards that he got charged with assaulting a man with a lead pipe. And then after that, there was something else again. And then the murders dating in 2010 started after that. So maybe they are the start of them. Who knows?
Who knows, yeah.
But anyway, so the statement of fact is he did and some of these details, we won't go into them in particularly, but you may recall that to dispose of the evidence, he dismembered the bodies and
spread them out through
around 53 yeah. Mallory Crescent in Toronto. The poor woman that lives there, like, he was a family friend. He'd been doing the gardening for 10 years.
Okay.
You know, clearing the snow, trimming the hedge. And she'd met some of these guys and had no idea that this was happening. So it's... And what we now know, what was revealed as a result of this, is that Bruce MacArthur actually kept mementos from all of his 8 victims. Certain personal items that had belonged to the victims were found in his possession. It is also alleged that he had staged some of the the victims, and that ligatures or some kind of binding had been used as well in the process.
Yeah, I'd heard that they had found photos that he had. That was, I mean, that was the nail in the coffin, so to speak, that they had found photos of the victims in not flattering images that he had staged them in. I mean, yeah, this is grim.
Yeah, he took photos. Not all of them were sexual in nature, the murders. Some of them, the majority of them were, but not all of them were. I think the first two were not, and they may have escalated to include that. What the police revealed was that had the last one, Andrew Kisman, not been reported missing within 3 days, they would have missed a key piece of evidence. That is how they found him. It was the quick reporting that was able to capture Bruce MacArthur.
So is there any other news from the past few days about the plea or the case or the deal or any of that? Other than that he confessed, well, not confessed, but he pled guilty to the 8 murders.
Yeah, so what we did learn was, some of which we knew before, that and actually some evidence, some information that came out in October as a result of a CBC and others who did a Freedom of Information request. And what we now know about the investigation was that they had a warrant. I think we knew bits of this. They had a warrant to enter his property to clone his hard drives, to gather evidence related to, I think, specifically Andrew Kisman. And that they were in there for maybe an hour before he came back from work suddenly, and they all had to run away and hide and pretend nothing had happened. And that was very dramatic.
They
entered
the premises without him being
there?
Yeah. I didn't know that was legal in Canada.
Well, they had a warrant to that effect.
Oh, okay.
They went in, cloned his hard drive. They got like 45% of the hard drive, and then left before he would notice it. They put GPS trackers on his vehicles. They put cameras on 53 Mallory Crescent, which was suspected of being the sort of location that he was dispersing the bodies. There was an extremely thorough police investigation into him at the end. One of the investigators, I think it was from Project Houston, which was one of the previous ones, or Project Prism, which was the one before that, or the other way around, had been briefed on it and, you know, knew that there's very likely a link between them. Even though in September, or I think it was in December, they said, police chief Mark Saunders said that there was no serial killer on the loose. And that these various gay men disappearing weren't related to each other. Whereas at that point, they did know, and they were actively investigating Bruce MacArthur. Now,
could they have been... Now, just to play devil's advocate, is it possible that they said that to throw the serial killer off the... Like, to throw off the serial killer Well, I mean, we now know it's Bruce MacArthur, obviously, but, you know, if they were like, oh, yeah, definitely it's a serial killer, and we're zeroing in on who it was, I mean, they could have lost the trail and failed to catch the guy, as opposed to, you know, playing dumb. At which point, if they did that, hopefully there'd be some kind of an internal memo in some file somewhere that says, you know, we're just saying this for media, but hey, future people, this, I mean, presumably, I don't know. Like, is there, did the chief of police actually genuinely believe there was no serial killer, or was it some kind of thing he was doing for strategic or optics or not cause a panic or something?
I think it would be ridiculous if the chief did not know.
Okay.
Being that he was arrested 2 weeks later. You know what I mean?
Like,
you know, the guy must have known.
Right, yeah.
And you're right, so it may have been an operational thing. And the fact that...
But if there were, there should be a note somewhere
that
he was lying to the public for reasons.
Well, yeah, and that's actually part of the conversation here, is the extent of the police investigation is only now becoming apparent.
Yeah, yeah.
So the biggest critique about the Toronto police leaving a serial killer on the loose in Toronto for years.
Yeah.
Is not as fair a critique as it was. Mm-hmm. There are still a lot of things to be said about its investigation. There are a lot of things to be said about...
Yeah, I'd heard that...
You know what I mean?
Because there's a policy in Ontario that every cold case needs to be reopened. I think it's every 6 years. You know, even if there's no new evidence, you have to reopen it and keep looking at it. And some of the earlier murders had fallen into cold case territory. And that... Just because of turnover within the police, it would be like every 3 or 4 years there'd be a new investigator on it. And like one investigator would ride hard in the community and kind of didn't really do a very good job of interviewing, mm-hmm. you know, the friends and family of the victims. And other people would look very strongly at the friends and family of the victims, but kind of just ignored the community. And it was kind of inconsistent, and it was, you know, in some ways it was really heavy on one side and not on the other. And because... You know, one person would come through and do an investigation and nothing would come of it. When the next one came through, either the family or the gay community would just sort of like shrug their shoulders at them and been like, dude, where are the notes from the last person who came through? So, I mean, from what I understand, like that would be frustrating. And I cannot imagine being a community member or a loved one of a victim and seeing like 3 or 4 different investigators over a 10-year period coming back with the same questions and being able to take them seriously. So, I mean, I could totally understand that the community is disappointed and upset, mm-hmm. even if there are operational reasons that will come to light in another year as to why they were doing that. I could completely understand. It's very reasonable that the community is upset. Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, in 2010, 3 men went missing.
Yeah.
And it was Gandaraj, Navaratnam, Abdul Basa, and Mahid who all went missing, and there was no sign of them. Everyone's like within months of each other. It was very close.
Yeah.
That they all went missing. Anyways, in December of 2012, when the police, a month after the police launched Project Houston to kind of figure out what happened to those men,
right?
They issued a whole bunch of warrants to track vehicles. A lot of those warrants were sealed. We don't know what the contents of them are. Some of the reasons for why it's sealed is that they were protecting a confidential source. Others is that there was an underage victim. We don't know who that was. Mm. There's still a lot of questions still out there.
Or if it's a warrant for an innocent person, you don't want to be like, well, why were they following this person where it turns out there's nothing wrong? It just, yeah.
In 2014, that task force was shut down. But we also know that in 2012... they went after James Alex Brunton. That was when I was telling you that they went on this random weird side chase thinking that there was a cannibal eating people. Okay, remember that story?
I do remember, yeah.
Yeah, so they thought it was him. It wasn't him.
Okay.
But in the end, he was arrested for possession of child pornography in connection to a case with the FBI. But he wasn't the one killing these gay men.
I mean, they caught someone, so that's... You know, that's a good, strong B+.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not until 2017 that they actually start to zero in on Bruce MacArthur, where they start tracking him and they find Kinsman's blood in Bruce MacArthur's van and, you know, other things like that. They find the bracelet of one of the victims in Bruce MacArthur's possession. And it all sort of relates. Yeah, so it was on December the 8th that they said that there was no evidence of a serial killer. Whilst that same week, they're installing cameras.
They were tracking a serial killer.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, dear.
And on January 18th, they saw a man entering Bruce MacArthur's apartment, which is what I told you we talked about before.
Right, and that's when they're like, oh, dang, we were going to wait on this, but we got to do this now.
Yeah.
Because I do remember that. That was the story that they were just monitoring him. And then at the last minute, you know, because apparently there were people in the community who had hookups with him where nothing bad had happened. But, of course, the police were like, we can't guarantee that this is going to be one of those events. So we got to charge in there now. And that was the other thing that spooked a lot of people. The number of people in the community who are like, oh, I recognize that guy. So, I mean, that's That's got to be an awkward place to be in as a community member.
Well, exactly. So the guy that was, when they busted on the front door, the guy was in restraints. He was tied down. Mm-hmm. The CBC in Toronto interviewed a whole bunch of people who had been conjugal with Bruce MacArthur in the past.
Right.
And all three of them were like, some of the things he wants to do in the bedroom, that's a no-go for me.
Yeah.
So clearly some things maybe got extreme in that sense.
Yeah. So our mutual friend who owns a fetish store here in town, mm-hmm. Wanda from Wicked Wanda's, she once told us that you should never trust somebody who wants to do any BDSM within the first 4 months of meeting you. And she personally has a 1-year rule, but the idea being you cannot trust somebody well enough to do some of that stuff because you need to know that, you know, the safe word is going to be respected, that they're going to not hurt you, that they know how to, you know, distinguish your body language and your facial expressions and the tone of your voice to see, are they playing around or is this serious and that sort of thing. So, I mean, the fact that a lot of people in the community said, you know, this guy was top to bottom made out of red flags. I've spoken to people who are in the kink scene who said that their understanding of the Bruce MacArthur story, that you don't need to have been there to spot the red flags, that there were problems going on there. And presumably none of those guys went back for seconds. So clearly there was, you know, there was a, they agreed.
Yeah. I mean, look, don't get me wrong here. The scale of the Toronto Police Force investigation was unprecedented, literally. They investigated 8 properties trying to find these remains. And if you remember, they actually had giant heaters out to de-thaw the ground.
So they could dig it up,
because it was frozen over, because it was the middle of January. He was charged in January, arrested in January, charged in February. I think a couple months later, they got a warrant for his apartment. And then they gathered 1,800 pieces of evidence from the apartment, which is the single largest forensic examination in Toronto police history. Like, they went, it was thorough.
That's like probably top 10 for Canadian history as well. That is a, whoa. Oh, that's a lot of plastic baggies.
The canine units didn't finish searching nearly 100 properties until June. So anyone who got the gardening done by this guy...
Mm-hmm. Probably their neighbors as well, just in case.
Had their canine unit coming up and find it.
Mm-hmm.
They found more remains in July of 2018. It's phenomenal. It was the remains of Mahid Kayan that they found at that time, who he was charged for murder with and arrested. But no, it is truly a monumental case. You know, and I think what I want to talk about next when we get back from our first song is the fact that there was such a bad communication with the Toronto LGBT community who knew that these men were going missing.
Yeah, there's a public relations story here.
Yeah, it massively soured the relationship, which is why there's such a push against police participation at Pride. Now that we know the breadth and depth of the investigation, maybe that will start to win over some people who felt like it wasn't being investigated properly.
Because everything you're talking about right now, all the investigation, the amount of evidence they've had to gather, the number of sites they've had to investigate, they've poured millions of dollars into this, clearly. Yeah. Clearly.
I mean, it took 6 bodies before, like 6 missing people before, you know...
The serial killers are hard to find,
though. The bulk of it was thrown in.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But anyways, we're going to jump to our first song. This is actually France's Eurovision. It's the France's Eurovision singer, Bilal Hassani.
It is that time of year where we start talking about
Eurovision. Anyway, this is Rui by Bilal Hassani. The song...
Roi.
Oh my God, that's so embarrassing.
Roi. It's the word for king.
This is Roi by Bilal Hassani.
You did it! You did it!
And
you did it French! And it was good! High five, actually, up
thank
here.
You. This song has English and French in it, which I quite like, and is actually a theme we're going to do throughout the other songs in the episode as well. So this is I've already forgotten what it is. Roi by Bilal Hassani, and we'll be back just after this. I am me, and I know I will always be. Je suis free, oui, j'invente ma vie. Ne me demandez pas qui je suis. Moi, je suis le même depuis tout petit. Et malgré les regards, les avis, je pleure, je sors et je ris. You put me in a box, want me to be like you. J'suis pas dans les codes, ça dérange beaucoup. The end of the day, you cannot change me, boo. Alors, laisse-moi m'envoler. I'm not rich, but I'm shining bright.
La différence fait qu'il y a beaucoup de gens qui me critiquent, il y a beaucoup de gens qui essayent de me rabaisser, qui me disent des choses assez abominables, mais je garde la tête haute et je passe outre parce que je préfère rester dans le positif.
Il s'assume, tu vois, il prend des perruques, il se maquille. Je pense qu'il faut des gens comme ça.
On choisit son travail, sa coiffure, ses amis, sa routine, parfois l'amour aussi. Ça passe ou ça casse, mais ça.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And my name is Luke Smith.
No. You are Sebastian.
Oh, am I? Okay. Yeah. I'll go back to being Sebastian.
Yeah, thanks. I did notice that you copied my intonation as well. That didn't go unnoticed, so thank you for that. Only slightly insulted.
I've been watching a lot of 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown. So all you UK listeners can know that there are geeks over here who are totally into that. And I have a tendency to be really good at the maths, and I'm okay at the letters. So, yeah.
You play along?
I do play along. Okay. I do, and I get nines and eights every so often, too.
Sometimes. Very exciting. I do a little bit in this.
And then my favorite, who's the guy again with the...
Joe Lycett.
Oh, God, Joe Lycett. If anybody out there knows Joe Lycett, get him to contact me, because he's 100% my type. Just put glasses on him. And that is exactly what I want out of life.
Yes.
Yes. Even the fact that he's, like, sassy, but not mean. That's, like, I love someone who can look you straight in the eye and sass you without offending you. I
His
love stand-up that.
His stand-up is great. Joe Lycett. Stand-up. Oh. He's very funny. Very, very funny. He, yeah. Oh, he's great.
Yeah. But we were talking about the unfortunate
events. We're talking about Toronto.
Because everyone's always talking about Toronto.
I know. Well, we talked about Bruce MacArthur earlier and about how the Toronto police actually did a monumental investigation eventually.
But they just didn't let us know.
Yeah, but I think some of the early investigations weren't great. We do know that the earlier investigations were actually referred by Mike and Zynga internally as well for investigation, because it wasn't done up to scratch.
Okay.
So we know for a fact that
it was subpar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least it's being investigated for appearing to be subpar.
Yeah, yeah.
At the very least.
And there is the number one story to come out. Like, as we're learning more, it turns out the... And we already knew that it was a public relations issue. They had a public relations mm-hmm. issue right from the start. Now the details are changing, so that
well,
it's...
Well, there's also things like the police raid of Etobicoke Park.
Well,
you know, they've...
I'm just talking about the Bruce McCarthy
case. Yeah, no, the trauma police isn't doing a very great job.
Yeah, I am a skeptic and an optimist, and I would still only give them a C+.
So
not a failing grade, but not great either.
So we talked about how the Toronto Pride decided that the police should come back.
Mm.
And then within weeks, like, magically gets a massive $500,000 grant from Public Safety Canada.
Right.
Coincidence, maybe? I don't know.
To do a thing they're not well suited to do?
Yeah. And, like, it was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Well, a backgrounder was released to the confidential backgrounder was sent to Pride members ahead of their meeting about whether or not the police should participate in Pride. But before we get to that, let me tell you about this backgrounder.
What backgrounder?
Oh, and it was Pride. Just like a bit of information. Before you come in and vote, here's this bit of information you should pay attention to.
Because everybody reads the literature.
Confidential, and it's from the board, and it got leaked, obviously. So they've been creating a safe space, an event. They said that the police could come, but not with uniforms, not without sidearms. The police did not agree to them. And around that same time, there's a big old reorganization. So if you recall, after the Black Lives Matter protest at Pride...
2016?
The whole leadership got shaken out, and most of the staff left.
Yeah.
So they had to hire on all new staff. That is what they're saying is causing the issue, but their independent audit says there's $700,000 in debt.
Okay.
So I don't know what kind of severance package they had, but like, I don't know how restructuring can throw you off by $700,000.
There were very large air quotes when he said restructuring.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so essentially said, Pride Corona, as our audited statements suggest, Pride Toronto could not withstand any threats to its funding and continue to operate. So there was very clear language that they don't want any more shocks to the system, such as banning police.
Right.
Because they, otherwise their ability to continue to operate comes into question. And it was seen as a bit of a veiled threat from the board.
Like, you must agree to this.
Yeah, and not agreeing means that maybe Pride will just cease to be.
Part of the problem is... Okay, so there's two sides to this, and I think both sides have a point. On the one side, you have people saying Pride is too big. Pride has grown too big, and we need to take in all these... The pink, what's the word I'm looking for? Not the pink dollar, the thing where
sponsor dollars.
The pretend that you're gay, but you're not friendly.
Pinkwashing.
That's it. With all the pinkwash dollars. So on the one hand, we have to accept pinkwashing dollars, like TD funds everything, but
yeah.
I don't particularly.
So funny
know what
story
they do.
About that. The CBC was talking to Nuwama, and they're like, did the police decision in 2016-17 impact sponsorship relations?
Mm.
And the answer was no. Everyone still loves us. It'd be great. No difference whatsoever. Until this confidential memo, which says, we were unable to reestablish all of our sponsorship relations.
Okay.
in time for our fiscal year.
Well, there were a lot of people who were like, they were okay with the police being there. They were okay with the police not being there. The problem was how they dealt with the situation. That's what they didn't like. But anyway, yeah. So there's on the one hand, you have people saying Pride is getting too big. It's getting far too large, and they're having to accept these dollars in order to make it happen. We need to scale back. But the problem with that is, who are you going to tell can't come to Pride? It's as big as it is because there's millions of people around Ontario and the world who want to go to Toronto Pride. If you scale it down to a picnic in the park, you're not going to be able to fit the entire community in that park, which means you're going to have to tell some people they're not allowed to attend. Who are you going to tell can't come? Who are you going to assign the position to do that? It's unfair, profoundly unfair. On the other hand, you have people, you know, you have this sort of reality of the situation, which is that if you do want to hold a festival downtown, it's really expensive. It costs a lot of money to get the street closures. If you get a street closure, you have to pay for the security. If you get the street closure and the security, you also need volunteers to administrate stuff. You also need this. You also need that. If you want to have this thing happen. So it becomes expensive in order to get that many people to show up. So now you're kind of between a rock and a hard place where if you want a festival large enough, even for just the community of Toronto to show up, you're at least a couple million in the hole in licensing alone, probably. All right. Well, licensing and infrastructure, getting the barricades and all that. So, I mean, it's quite expensive, but then how do you pay for that? And it just turns into this spiral of what do we do about this
situation? It does not need to be that big.
It doesn't need to be that big. It's about, I would say it's about 1.5, maybe 2 times bigger than it needs to be.
Well,
but you can't scale it down too much because there's millions of people who want to go.
So the Toronto Pride made a decision a couple of days after the vote.
Right.
Where they've now announced that Toronto Pride is going to be smaller.
Okay. How much smaller, though?
The parade is going to be the same.
Okay.
Now they're only actually having 2 parties instead of 5 over the course of the entire month of June.
But the parties are also fundraisers. This is one of
But they're also extremely expensive.
But they've also gone. If you raise more money than you spend, it's worth it.
But they've gone down to 3 stages from 15. Why on earth were they running 15 stages to begin with?
Bear in mind, okay, I've been to some of the quote-unquote stages, and it's basically a riser the size of a king-size bed with, like, you know, a lady and a guitar on it. So, I mean, some of their stages are very, very small and sort of off down side alleys. And quite frankly, I like them a little bit better because you can actually get right up there. I actually remember... Oh, must have been like 2005 or something. I was in Toronto for Pride. And I actually had a conversation with a musician while they were on the stage because there was like 10 people watching them. And she was just like, how you doing? Thanks for coming out here. You enjoying the show? And I was like, yeah, I'm enjoying the show. And somehow it turned into a chat. But anyway, those side stages I actually kind of like better. It's more intimate. Mm-hmm. You get to meet local musicians. It's really good. The huge stages where they fly in, I don't know, people from RuPaul's Drag Race. Like, it's not as intimate. They never put local talent on those stages. And when they do, people don't know who they are. So when you get those smaller stages spread out throughout town, you can actually get to know what's going on in your community a little bit better. So long as, and here's the problem, so long as they don't overbuild those stages and make it, you know, a $10,000 stage where really they just need a riser and, you know, an extension cord so they can plug in their equipment. So, I mean, it's an issue of, I think they were heading in the right direction, but they were overspending on things that should have been smaller. Yeah. I think the overall, like, I think 15 stages is fine, but they don't all need to be full structures, well-lit. Put a tent over it because you're in the sun.
I disagree. I don't think Pride Toronto needs to have 15 blooming stages.
Including, like, the small ones where you just put 2 people on days. It?
I mean, you can get your local pub to stick some thingy picnic tables together, you know. You don't need Pride Inc. to be running 15 stages. No wonder why there's 700 grand in the hole. Like, it doesn't make... And that's the thing. So they say, and they've said repeatedly, that the police decision is not related to their financial troubles. But the evidence is not looking great.
Yeah.
There has also been... So the vote, I'm going to just mention quickly, came 163 to 161 against the police participating.
Okay.
And everyone is like, ooh.
Full stop?
That is so close. Yeah.
Because I'm in the camp. Uniform. I'm in the camp of let them participate in Pride, but not the parade.
Well, no, it's in the parade in uniform. So they're not invited in uniform in the parade.
But they can do other events if they want?
I'm sure they're welcome to other things. I don't know the details of it, but...
Because I do think the police, they do need venues for the police and the community to integrate into each other and to have better relations.
Specifically the parade for at least 2 years.
I don't think, I think 2 years is fair. I think 2 years, no parade, I think that's fair. But everything else, I think... The worst thing they could do is isolate the community from the police. That'll just foment animosity.
Well, they need to build that relationship. But what was shady,
right,
was, and this is an allegation.
Okay.
Now, Nawama, who is the executive director, has been fending off the alleged mismanagement, the alleged misleading of what some of these background causes are.
The alleged misallocation of funds.
I'm not familiar with that particular allegment. But Beverly Baines, who's a voting member, spoke to the CBC, and another voting member, Christian Milloy, spoke to the Toronto Star. Both of them said that the fact that 244 new members just showed up the day before the election is kind of suspicious.
Mm-hmm. You know what I call that?
Suspicious?
Well, it's the NRA tactic. I've mentioned this to you before. Because the NRA used to be all about gun safety, and it used to be about guns in the hands of people who live in the countryside but not in the city. It was all about education. It was all about safety. It was all about promoting mature adult use of guns. And then one day they had an annual general meeting in the late 60s. And 400 members of Lockheed Martin showed up, paid their fee, became voting members, and voted themselves in. And it's really, by the way, if you're involved in any organizations, dear listener, who has voting and a membership and all that, close your loopholes, because it is so easy to take advantage of poorly written terms and conditions. And I know it's nerdy to get all excited about policy, but like, if this is what happened at Toronto Pride, I mean, that first of all, that's poorly written policies.
Well,
and it's poorly enforced policies.
They had 265 members, and then 244 got registered overnight. I mean, that's not
how it's supposed to work.
It wasn't strictly overnight, according to Nawama speaking to the Star. They, both sides of that particular debate, registered members. Although in speaking to the CBC, there was talk about the fact that volunteers with Pride are able to register as members. And I think 60 odd of them ended up being registered as members pretty much, ahead of the vote. Okay. So the allegations of stacking by the board and by the executive director is not an allegation that's easy to fend off, given sort of what we're seeing coming out of Toronto. What's really difficult and what's really frustrating is that in speaking to the CBC, Nawama said, you know, for some of the critics, they don't know. They weren't in the room. That's not the sense that I got. I had a totally different impression.
Right.
Well, she banned all the media. So like, how is anybody supposed to know what's going on? It's very shady. Yeah. Very, very shady.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's enough Pride Toronto for today, I think. We're going to play out the next song, Cœur de Poètes, with Don La Nuit, and featuring Loud. And we'll be back just after this.
Should I correct your pronunciation on that one, too?
No.
Est-ce qu'on parle encore de pacte? On sait juste utiliser. Et le mal qui s'impose au fond n'est pas ce qu'on s'est donné. Les lumières de nos ombres, ce qui feignent de briller. Je m'y plonge et j'y somnole, enfin, ne plus me réveiller. Les gens tournent autour de moi, ne m'ont pas vu m'endormir. Au son des basses qui résonnent dans mon tout, mon être chavire. Les amours se rencontrent enfin, alors qu'on me voit souffrir. Je rêve, je m'envole.
Ta chance, ils ont joué ta chanson. Je t'ai parlé toute la nuit, j'ai pas dit grand chose. Je sais que tu penses que j'y pense, mais tu penses trop. Ok, j'ai pris l'appel et puis après. Crois-moi, je suis difficile à suivre, je suis facile à perdre. L'ennui des jeunes adultes, passer la nuit seul à deux. Mais disparu sans signature, je sais pas dire adieu. Je suis jamais bien loin, je suis jamais bien là. Bruxelles, Paris, Berlin, Jarbella. Traverser le monde pour essayer.
essayer de remplacer un monde par un autre que j'arrive à peine à replacer. I say, two glasses full of moonshine, sunglasses full of moonshine. Les grands classes qu'on est sous le charme, and baby that's all I need.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is still Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian this time.
This time he is Sebastian. We did check. And we don't have an awful lot of time, but I did want to share with folks that we saw the Bryan Singer story that came out in The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be printed in The Atlantic in March. I think they're a quarterly paper, so it's like the online version was out way before the print.
Right.
They've been working on it for a year.
Oh, wow.
And it is the allegations of several sexual misconduct allegations against victims, many of whom were underage. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 17, some as young as 14 in the allegations. Very serious. The actual piece by The Atlantic, if you want to get an idea of what the whole story is about, give the Atlantic article a read. We will be linking it.
Yeah.
And kind of going into the detail there. There has been some fallout.
I mean, who thinks they're not going to get caught? This is the number one thing I don't get about all these things that keep happening. Like, if it's, you know, one or two events, you mistook a 16-year-old for a 21-year-old, and they're like, dude, no. And you're like, whoa. And then you have that one bad event, that's one thing. But this is a pattern.
Yeah.
And it keeps happening. And, like, who does this and doesn't think, oh, maybe this will catch up with me someday? Mm-hmm. Like, what bubble do they live in? It's absolutely alarming.
What really shocked me and what I kind of wanted to talk about is, I'm sure you've heard that gossip about a pedophile ring in Hollywood, and there's always a pedophile ring somewhere.
Pizzagate,
you know, maybe not Pizzagate, but there's always allegations of
Pizzagate's tangential to it.
Always allegation there's pedophile rings everywhere.
Well, the
hidden drama.
Well, so Corey Feldman actually was courted by one of these things. So, I mean, there are adult celebrities now who used to be child celebrities who confirm these things used to exist. For sure. They were saying, at least when I was young, they did exist. Macaulay Culkin has spoken out against them. Macaulay Culkin has also spoken out in defense of Michael Jackson. And it's super interesting finding out after all this time that Michael Jackson actually protected all these kids. And Michael Jackson pulled aside Elijah Wood's mother, because Elijah Wood started acting when he was 4.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Jackson warned her about the pedophiles of Hollywood. And that's why Elijah Wood is like one of the few child actors who isn't messed up, because his mother protected him. And it's tragic that, like, it's one of those things where, on the one hand, half the allegations are just weird, messed up conspiracy theories. But on the other hand, you have adults who used to be child celebrities saying, no, it's absolutely true. I was at parties like that. So it's one of those things where I think it is a real thing that happens. But I also think people on the outside who are not in the Hollywood inner circles, they just point everywhere and they're like, there's a pedophile and there's a pedophile and there's a pedophile and there's a whole pedophile ring under a pizza shop. And you know, it's
almost an hysteria at that point.
It is a little bit. Well, it definitely is, actually. Yeah. So it's one of those things where, like, we know that it at least for sure has existed. To what degree it exists now is an open question.
Well, this is what frustrates me, because it's definitely happening. So I'll tell you about this guy, Colin Rector. Set up this company called Digital Entertainment Network, or DEN, and they operated out of a house in West Hollywood, and they were going to make TVs and movies for 14 to 24-year-olds. That's what they're going to do.
Renting a studio out of a house in West Hollywood screams pornography to me.
Well,
because that's like half of the studios run out of a single house in West Hollywood. They're not for kids.
So anyways, Singer invested in it, as did lots of people. I think Microsoft, Dell, Chase, a whole bunch of people had invested in it. It was a huge thing.
So it was meant to be like an alternative to Nickelodeon of a thing.
Well, I think
or at least on paper.
Maybe, yeah. And the former Mighty Ducks star, Brock Pierce, who was 17 at the time, joined. And yeah, you're right. It was certainly what it was supposed to be all about. But Dan ended up having a lot of younger boys coming.
Mm-hmm.
Always free-flowing alcohol at all the events.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them weren't over a certain age. One, The Atlantic goes into a case about who they call Andy, who is 14 at the time. And Collins Rector, who is this individual, engaged in certain acts with Andy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the environment that Bryan Singer was in. He was often at the parties at Den, which was often had underage boys there. Mm-hmm. Senior executives who had worked at, I think the former president of, I want to say Disney Television was involved somehow. Like, we're talking really senior people. He had just put out Apt Pupil, which launched Bryan Singer's career. You know, these are people who are doing really well. And then he ended up fleeing to Spain.
Who? Bryan Singer?
No, Collins Rector.
Okay.
He fled to Spain because he was avoiding being arrested for transporting a minor across state lines for the purposes of sex. And when he was arrested, there was a crap ton of child pornography on his laptop. So, this is not Bryan Singer, but Bryan Singer is alleged of having sexual acts with people from 17 down to 14.
Mm-hmm.
It is shocking. This article is very in depth, but what it indicated to me was some of the elements, like in order to be memorable, be in good company, stand out to Bryan Singer for casting, for being involved in like the X-Men movies, that for these conversations, they would bring their younger, cute looking male friends with them to kind of create an atmosphere. And young men were being traded like pawns for favors within the industry.
Did you say pogs?
Pawns.
Pawns.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not pogs.
Pogs also
could work. Yeah,
as a metaphor, yeah.
It's insane. It is truly insane that sort of what this was indicating. And it hasn't really blown up as much as I would have expected. Bryan Singer is still expected to walk away with $40 million off of
a lot of the Bohemian Rhapsody. A lot of the media companies in the States are also owned by the kinds of companies that invested in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, CNN is owned by Ted Turner, who owns a whole bunch of other things. And then a lot of things are owned by Disney. And this is one of those things which sounds kind of conspiracy-ish, but it also is valid that a lot of the media companies that control how these things get played out in the public forum mm-hmm. don't want their own name associated with it.
Well, you know, what happens on a yacht of a tech billionaire with a Hollywood director who's doing really well for himself stays on the yacht of the tech billionaire, you know? And it's that sort of that environment of they're rich and famous enough to get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, in Britain, we've had so many moments where dozens of politicians would have been, you know, thrown to the wolves. And maybe this is, we're edging towards Hollywood having its same moment.
Yeah.
I mean, Bryan Singer has accused The Atlantic of a homophobic smear campaign. What's-his-face, Kevin Spacey, also alleged that the allegations were homophobic. And I think alleging homophobia only gets you so far.
I think there's
a lot of meat on the bones to this investigation. Yeah.
If Bryan Singer went to one of those parties, said this is freaky and weird and not for me, and no one's going to believe me if I report
it. And just didn't have a track record of it.
And just never went back because it freaked him out. Mm-hmm. And then they smeared him. He might have a point. But if he went enough to have a track record, that doesn't look good on him.
No. Well, we'll be following the story. We did not have time to cover the story about Jesse Smollett from, I think it's the TV show Empire, who was violently attacked just last week and the sort of fallout from that. We also didn't have time to talk about Angola decriminalizing homosexuality, which is pretty cool news.
But it happened.
It did happen.
I mean, the bulk of the story is Angola, semicolon, decriminalized homosexuality.
I know, and that would have been really cool, but we've run out of time.
Yeah, too bad we can't release the news that Angola decriminalized homosexuality.
Because if we could, we would be talking about it.
Yeah.
What we do have time, though, is Mika Staring at the Sun, the French version, which also blends English and French.
Yes.
I also love Mika.
Mika's fantastic, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I have been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thanks for listening.
Watch the sunset. Hold it from afar. Close as I get to being where you are. Cette mélodie, je la chante partout. Pour qu'elle te poursuive, qu'elle te rappelle à nous. Here I stand. Fool.